culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to talk about fixing things. Not just complaining about the way they are, but talking about how you make it better. There's a law professor who's doing some of that about fixing the Supreme Court. So we don't have this ridiculous situation every time when a justice dies and then there's a bitter, bitter, utterly partisan, politicized, and angry confirmation process. We will talk about his idea for changing the Supreme Court. No, it does not involve court packing at all. That's a Democratic idea. We will also talk about a Proud Boys rally that is, in fact, coming up, after all, in Portland, Oregon. Where else? That's just what they need. We'll talk about that as well on the Michael Medved Show. But let's talk about fixing things. President Trump is speaking live about a new health care plan. And he's speaking in Charlotte, North Carolina, part of his campaign stop in a crucial swing state. Listen to the president.
Good management. We manage it properly. We have tremendous people working on it. Simultaneously with all of this, we are joining in a lawsuit to end this ill-conceived plan. I'm in court to terminate this really, really terrible situation. If we win, we will have a better and less expensive plan that will always protect individuals with pre-existing conditions. If we lose, what we have now is better than the original version of Obamacare, by far. Much better. Much better. Again, we will always protect patients with pre-existing conditions. So today I'm laying out my vision for the future of American healthcare with the America First Healthcare Plan. As we restore America to full strength, the first healthcare plan will be a core part of our national renewal. In a few moments, I'll sign an executive order outlining the three pillars of my plan and directing my administration to implement these critical reforms. The first pillar of my plan is more choice for the American patients. Very important. The last administration
speaking in North Carolina.
Consumer choice through the greatest health care lie ever told. If you like your plan, you can keep your plan. If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. You remember that? 28 times that was stated by our president, but it turned out not to be true. When I took office, more than 50% of counties nationwide offered plans from only a single insurance company on the individual market. Starting next month, more than 90% of the counties will have multiple options to choose from, which is really some difference. Under our plan, you'll have the freedom to shop for the option that is right for you and your family. These options include new affordable choices that cost up to 60% less than Obamacare. Think of that, 60% less. For example, we're opening up short-term plans that are much cheaper than Obamacare and that can be customized to your individual needs. We're also offering association health plans that allow small businesses to pool together and offer more affordable policies to their employees. These are tremendous options that didn't exist before we came into office. And through a massive expansion of health reimbursement arrangements, millions of Americans will be able to shop for a plan of their choice on the individual market and then have their employer cover the full cost. Furthermore, I'll work to make individual health care premiums fully tax deductible. That will be a big difference. Through these and other reforms, we're putting American patients back in charge and we're putting them first. My plan will also revolutionize access to telehealth. That's something that really has taken off during the pandemic.
Well, because it's of COVID-19. It does sound like the president is offering the outlines of a substantive and positive and market-oriented plan, precisely the kind of thing that Republicans have been talking about for a very long time. The question, of course, here, and he's going to get slammed on it, is the timing, which is he has to do this because people are very nervous about this this case that'll be decided. It probably won't be decided until next year, but they're going to hear oral arguments on the case, and you'll have some indication of which way the court is leaning coming up on November 10th. Now, let us hope that that court has a new justice sitting in the court. During this trip, President Trump, I believe, is supposed to be meeting with Judge Barbara Lagoa, who is one of the two apparent finalists, at least according to White House reports. Now, of course, he could pull a surprise. He could pull a surprise. Brett Kavanaugh was something of a surprise. Last time, Amy Coney Barrett had been considered to be the front runner. So we will find out, and we will hear more about the plan. I hope we can discuss it tomorrow. Do you want to go back for a few moments more? Let's go back to the president, who is outlining details about his new health care plan which clearly the kind of thing that the president is talking about would require legislation. He can't do it as an executive order. And I don't think he's even suggesting that. Let's go back to the president.
Transparency. And transparency is great for the great doctors, the good doctors, and it's also great for the great and good hospitals. That's where it's really fantastic for them, too, in addition, obviously, to the patients. For the first time ever, we will create true competition in healthcare. Both hospitals and insurance companies will be required to post all of their prices online. This transformative policy will allow you to see your exact out-of-pocket costs before you go for treatment, making it easy to shop for the best price. Costs will come way down. Some people think this will have a bigger impact than healthcare itself. It's a tremendous thing. No matter where it's been put, it's been an incredible service, and it's worked miracles. It's been brilliant for patients. Next, I'm taking on the lobbyists and the special interests to lower the price of prescription drugs. For years, American patients have subsidized socialist nations. And you know that we talk about it all the time. Congress, they come over. We've been talking about it for a long time. They've been talking about it for years. They know the problem. But we've been subsidizing socialist nations and others by paying the highest drug prices in the world by far. And yet we're the largest purchaser of prescription drugs by far. And this is all while countries got away with paying so much less. So much less, incredibly less. Under my plan, we will pay the exact same price as other countries. That's at the lowest level. So we will be matching the lowest price with what's now many times the highest price, and we won't pay a penny more. What will happen is the lower prices will come up a little bit, but you'll get discounts of 40, 50, 60, 80, 90, who knows, percent, numbers that you wouldn't even believe. And we were the only ones in 52 years to bring drug prices down. The last year, they went down, as you know.
That's the President of the United States giving his America First health care plan some of the details in a speech in North Carolina. Earlier today on this show, we were talking with Lonnie Chen about how much the president really does need to fill in the blanks and indicate how it is he's going to protect people with pre-existing conditions, how he should avoid the Democrats from scaring everybody at the consequences of the Supreme Court actually ruling, they won't rule until 2021, on the constitutionality of Obamacare again. That's a complicated case, and again, oral arguments coming up on that case on November 10th. Meanwhile, there's a radical proposal that's brilliant and simple and understandable on how to fix the Supreme Court. We'll get to that coming right up on the Medved Show. Okay. We'll be right back. on the Michael Medved Show. A lot of people are looking at this Supreme Court appointment business, not just with eagerness. And yes, I'm eager to see a new justice like Justice, maybe, Amy Coney Barrett or Justice Barbara Lagawa or whoever President Trump appoints, because the list he's prepared and the even a longer list of 40 people, including non-females on that list, they're all good folks. They're people who've been vetted by the Federalist Society, and the Federalist Society is outstanding. And one of the people who's been active in that group has just written a dynamite piece. Now, I'm eager to get him on the air. His name is Stephen Calabresi. And Stephen is a professor of law at Northwestern and a visiting professor of law at Yale, where his uncle was the dean of Yale Law School during my time there. And this is this new piece basically starts out by saying this. It starts out appropriately with a tribute to Justice Ginsburg, who, by the way, is the first person, a first female to be honored with basically lying in state and being honored at the Capitol and at the Supreme Court. But in any event, all Americans, writes Professor Calabresi, should mourn Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was a pioneer of women's constitutional rights, a brilliant jurist, and a close friend to many conservatives, including Justice Antonin Scalia and me. Justice Ginsburg, he writes, would send me long handwritten notes about my law review articles, though we most often disagreed. No wonder I was one of the leaders of the effort to appoint conservatives and libertarians to the federal bench. But she treated me and everyone else she knew with courtesy and respect. And he goes on to write, Justice Ginsburg's close friendships with Justice Scalia and Justice Robert H. Bork should teach us another lesson in the hyperpartisan world we occupy. We all need to do a better job of reaching out to those we disagree with, to make the effort to understand their perspectives and endeavor to get along with them. This is particularly the case now, writes Professor Calabresi, as the United States confronts a Supreme Court vacancy during a presidential election for the second time in 4 years. In the spirit of Justice Ginsburg's friendship with Justice Scalia, for whom I clerked, writes Calabresi, he says, I propose a constitutional amendment that would permanently reform a broken selection process for Supreme Court justices. Full colon, a single 18-year term for each of the court's members. And this is brilliant, and it's necessary, and it's doable. Because clearly he's right. The system is broken right now. To have these bitter fights where there's an attempt to destroy someone, as there was against Justice Kavanaugh, as they destroyed Judge Bork, somebody else with that I knew from Yale. And again, it's wrong. Okay, what's the advantage of a single 18-year term? He writes, Supreme Court justices often try to retire during the presidency of someone sympathetic to their jurisprudence. Of course, that doesn't always work. Justice Scalia died after almost 30 years on the high court trying to wait out President Barack Obama. And Justice Ginsburg died after nearly 27 years trying to outlast President Trump. Overall, though, strategic retirements give the justices too much power in picking their own successors, which can lead to a self-perpetuating oligarchy. The current system also creates the impression that the justices are mere political actors more than judges, which damages the rule of law. It may even change the way the justices view themselves. And then this point. It's crucial to understand this, and the American people need to be reminded of this. Professor Calabresi writes, no other major democracy in the world gives the justices on its highest court life tenure, nor do 49 of the 50 states. The longest terms are more like the 12-year terms served by the German Constitutional Court justices. Countries and states that do not have term limits have mandatory retirement ages. Many jurisdictions have both. The unpredictable American system of life tenure has led to four presidents who have picked six or more justices and four presidents who have picked none, as happened with Jimmy Carter. He never appointed a Supreme Court justice. That's probably a good thing. But this gives some presidents too much influence, writes Calabresi, on the Supreme Court, and others too little. It also leads to justices remaining on the Supreme Court when they are unable, either physically or mentally, to do the job, though this was not the case with Justice Ginsburg or Justice Scalia. Allowing lengthy tenures on the Supreme Court from 1971 to 2000, for instance, it's 29 years, justices who left the court had served an average of 25.6 years. That ignores Lord Acton's admonition that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The solution is for Republicans and Democrats to unite in supporting a constitutional amendment that fixes the size of the Supreme Court at its current nine justices, no court packing, in other words, each of whom would serve an 18-year non-renewable term, staggered so that one seat opens up during the first and third years of a president's four-year term. One-term presidents would be guaranteed two appointments. Two-term presidents would get four. Each two-year Senate session would consider a nominee for the Supreme Court. Presidents would no longer have the incentive to pick comparatively young nominees, say someone 45 or 50 years of age, to protect their influence decades into the future. Justices would lose their power to help pick successors who share their views by retiring strategically. In the case of early retirements or deaths, the president would nominate and the Senate would confirm a replacement to fill out the unexpired term, with no possibility of reappointment. Look, this could work so much better. 18 years is a very long time. And the idea that there is any advantage at all to serving more than 18 years, to having a bulk of justices up in their 80s, where people are worried about what their future is going to be. If you have some objection to this plan, you can try to give us a call, 1-800-955-1776. Judges are not involved, but a lot of local police officials are dealing with two dueling rallies that are coming up this weekend. Just what we need. Where else? In Portland, Oregon. We'll tell you about the latest coming up on the MedVed Show.
In this era of...
On the Michael Medved Show, we are in the middle of the autumn season. I just found out, and it's something I didn't even realize, that in Britain, they don't say fall, apparently. They say autumn. We say autumn here, and we say fall. So either way, use the promo code FALL40, and you can save a whole bunch of money, $20, which is real money. You can save that money on an annual MedHead membership. And that gives you access to this show at 24/7. And the cost is incredibly low. It's like 11 cents a day. And just go to michaelmedved.com, click on the MedHead membership, use the promo code FALL40. And in that process, you get 50% off, a full half price off for all new MedHead members. at ordering any material and download from the Medved History Store, including all kinds of relevant political material about the greatest landslides in American history, why they happened, the history of third parties, how they impacted, and then, of course, with our great political leaders from Lincoln to Reagan, George Washington, and more. Check it out at michaelmedved.com and become a Medhead member. Okay, Nancy Pelosi was not making any particularly noteworthy history today, but she was asked a good question at her weekly press conference. She does it every Thursday. And Nancy Pelosi said this about the idea of a religious test for Supreme Court nominees. Listen.
I agree that Article 6, which bans religious tests from being a qualification for office, do you think that that should apply to Supreme Court nominees as well?
I'm not going to get into anybody's interpretation of one thing or another. The confirmation is the work of the Senate, and I trust the judgment of our Democrats there to honor the Constitution.
Okay, one of the things nobody disagrees with, Speaker Pelosi, is there must be, it is in the Constitution itself, it's not an amendment, it's right in the text of the Constitution. There shall be no religious test for public office, not in this country. Which is why the Democrats, who apparently are getting ready to try to smear Judge Amy Coney Barrett, because she's a very devoted Catholic. She's a member of a Catholic charismatic group called People of Praise. It's a lovely group, by the way. But they're going to try to smear them as religious fanatics. And by the way, in the process, offend not just charismatic Catholics, but any Pentecostal Protestant Christians who are out there. I mean, it's just wrong. Because, again, this is a woman, Amy Coney Barrett, who has a 20-year record of writing law review articles, writing more than 100 judgments already as a member of the appeals court. She has a record. Focus on that. But maybe you don't like the church she attends. But should that really be the basis for an attack? Well, of course, the Democrats are desperate on this. And it's a shame. I'll tell you what else is a shame. The headline in the Seattle Times, it says, Proud Boys rally on Saturday raises concerns of more violence in Portland. Now, why would that be? The article, the Proud Boys will hold a rally Saturday at a park near the Columbia River, raising concerns of another round of violence in Oregon's largest city. The Proud Boys, who have a reputation for brawling with Antifa, have billed the event to showcase the group's, quote, love for America and Western values. It was initially scheduled for the downtown area, but last week was moved to Delta Park in North Portland to accommodate what organizers called an overwhelming amount of interest from across the nation, according to a statement released by the group. Now, this is fascinating because you may have heard that the Proud Boys applied for a permit at another location, and the city turned them down. City officials cited the need to comply with state COVID-19 guidelines, which limit gatherings to no more than 50 people, and require the gatherings to break up into groups of 10. Now, the Proud Boys are expecting to have, they say realistically, 1,000 people, maybe 2,000 there. And they might. It's also going to double as a Trump rally. But again, for people who really want to help the reelection of Donald Trump, I'm not sure the Proud Boys are a great association. The Proud Boys were formed, writes the Seattle Times, in 2016 by Gavin McInnes, the co-founder of Vice Media, as, quote, Western chauvinists who refuse to apologize for the modern world. In recent years, the group has gained a higher profile in the Pacific Northwest, including in Clark County in southwestern Washington. That, of course, is suburban Portland. In both Oregon and Washington, Proud Boys have been involved in altercations, including an August 23rd melee in Seattle, where punches were thrown and mace sprayed by both sides. In New York, two Proud Boys last year were sentenced to four-year prison terms for their roles in a 2018 assault on anti-fascist activists outside an event where McGinnis had given a talk. Portland Antifa activists and other protesters have been monitoring the Proud Boys' Saturday plans, naturally, and they have called for their own rally Saturday. Oh, great! Wonderful! They're going to be an Antifa rally and a Proud Boys rally. The Antifa rally is going to be providing music, free food, and speeches. Everybody wants to hear those speeches. I sure do. The two rallies will be 4 miles apart from each other. So how long will it take them before they start marching to disrupt the other side's rally? I hope they don't. But these two groups, Proud Boys and Antifa, they just love clubbing each other, shooting each other, and in some cases, killing each other. The Proud Boys have been put on edge by something that happened earlier this month. On September 5th in Vancouver, Washington, again, that's suburban Portland, one of their members, Shane Moon, was seriously injured when he was hit by a driver and thrown up onto the roof of a vehicle before slamming to the ground. A Vancouver man who later turned himself in was arrested on suspicion of first-degree assault and hit and run. He was released on $100,000 bail. The guy deliberately ran him over and left him for dead. Fortunately, Shane didn't die, said Flip Todd, a Pacific Northwest Proud Boy, at a Trump 2020 rally on September 7th. Todd and other Proud Boys say they recovered social media posts by the suspect that he took down from social media before turning himself into police. They say those posts indicate the suspect is an activist who identifies with Antifa and the Black Lives Matter movement. John McMullen, an attorney representing the man arrested, said his client is a supporter of Black Lives Matter movement, as are millions of other Americans, and he has no other knowledge of any ties he has to the Antifa movement. Okay, look, the question that I would ask people here is, this is a crucial time for our country. I mean, one of the things that everybody on all sides agrees, this election is important. It's important whether we're going to have another 4 years of Donald Trump, or we're going to have the 4 years of Biden-Harris. And the idea of going out to dueling rallies for these two groups in Portland, which are going to, it's going to result in more work and more danger for police officers and more destruction and more negativity and more hysteria. I don't understand why people do it, why they like it. We'll get to that and more coming up on the Medved Show. Oh, this is just great. A statement from the Oregon State Police, from the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. I feel so sorry for those guys. He wrote that his agency was busy responding to wildfires in the state, which, of course, have been disastrous, and that the state police have serious reservations about helping with crowd control ever since the city police agency's use of tear gas has been banned. In other words, what are you supposed to do? This goes back to that basic question about the Breonna Taylor case. In other words, if all of a sudden you're dealing with several thousand people, let's imagine, and it doesn't take a lot of imagine, let's imagine there are hundreds of Antifa people and BLM people, and they're gathered in one park And then 4 miles away, there are hundreds, they claim thousands, of Proud Boys and Patriots Prayer and Trump 2020 people who are all gathered together. And they're having a grand old time. And let's say some alcoholic beverages are consumed. And let's say that there's a great eagerness to go confront the other side. Now, this is very, very difficult for the police because people get wounded and killed if you allow street battles to go on. We are in a civilized country, for God's sake. What is this? More on the story about Portland this weekend. And I really do hope that cooler heads prevail and some people can listen to reason and call this off. The Proud Boys, and good for them. This is a good thing about the Proud Boys, who are very different from the Boogaloo Boys. The Boogaloo Boys spell it B-O-I-S anyway. The Proud Boys applied 2 days ago for a city permit to hold their Saturday rally at Delta Park. The application was denied yesterday. City officials cited the need to comply with state COVID-19 guidelines, which limit gatherings to no more than 50 people and require the gatherings to break up into groups of 10 each. No more than that. Proud Boy Chair Enrique Tarrio said the permit was submitted as a courtesy to the city, and he did not expect that it would be granted. He forecast that anywhere from 800 to 2,000 people might attend. This is in the different park. Protesters against racial injustice have been meeting in city parks for months with no permits and in groups that often number into the hundreds, sometimes into the thousands. When they were fighting the feds that Trump had sent out there, it was thousands who were determined to try to burn down the courthouse. As of Wednesday, the Antifa had not applied for a permit for their Saturday event, according to Mark Ross, a spokesperson for Portland Parks and Recreation. Okay, so what's supposed to happen here? You have these two groups, one on the right, one on the extreme left, and they both are planning to hold these big gatherings in violation of state policy. So what? Are the police going to try to bust them both? Or are the police going to try to save whatever energy or effectiveness they have for the job of actually keeping them from hurting each other? I wouldn't like that. And by the way, the mayor, oh, he's been wonderfully helpful. Ted Wheeler, the mayor of Portland, has basically just denounced Proud Boys. That's what he said. And it's completely outrageous. In other words, this guy who has been tolerant of all of these violent demonstrations now speaks out about Proud Boys. Again, let us hope for better times. Mark Leibovich, who's a smart reporter, was on MSNBC. And Willie Geist asked Mark Leibovich, who writes now for New York Times Magazine, about the basement strategy of the Joe Biden campaign. This is clip 17. And the fact that the Democrats seem to be hiding their ticket a little bit from what really is a friendly press. Listen to the question.
To see what the campaign told you about the availability of Joe Biden and now also of Senator Kamala Harris to the media to do interviews, to be out there. Part of it is because Donald Trump is so ubiquitous that it feels like you never see Joe Biden or Kamala Harris. But I'm hearing even this week some grumblings about Kamala Harris, who a lot of people believe is a great asset to the campaign, not being out there more, not talking to the press more often. She does some local interviews when she travels, for sure, and that's an important part of it. But the basement campaign is something that Donald Trump has gone after Joe Biden for. Is there something to that? And how is the campaign approaching the exposure of both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris?
Okay, good question. And here is the answer by Mark Leibovich, clip 18.
Harris has actually, as you mentioned, become a bit of a flashpoint. She's been pretty invisible. She has not done a press availability in, you know, really since she's been picked. And look, it's getting late. I mean, this is her. She has been the running mate for about half the time that, you know, it is between now and the election. And that's become a bit of a mystery. Now, the campaign would say that they will do these. They're just waiting for the right time. And the debates will probably move the needle far more than anything they can do in individual media presences. But still, it is becoming an issue. And it's something certainly, you know, in the parochial world of the press that we've talked about a lot.
And I think there are rumors, at least, that there's a certain amount of buyer's remorse. You could hear in that segment we played from Kamala in Detroit. She has not been terrific. I'll tell you something else that is very far from terrific. It's a brand new movie on Netflix, critically acclaimed. Should you bother some you Satan worshipers out there to go see The Devil All the Time? Listen.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
An intriguing collection of stars come together in a nightmarish film about the way religious faith warps the lives of countless residents of the American heartland. The title of this uniquely ugly concoction is The Devil All the Time, now available on Netflix.
Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness.
When people look back on it, they had no other choice.
But you have a choice to stay away from this film about the real-life town of, yes, Knock'em Stiff, Ohio, based on a novel by Donald Ray Pollock, who narrates 20 years of anguish involving multiple murders, mutilations, animal crucifixion, seduction of underage girls, and other horrors. The anti-Christian bias is altogether unmistakable. Rated R, as in rancid, 1.5 stars for the appalling The Devil All the Time.
This feature brought to you by the Thank Heaven Foundation.
Why do I say appalling? Well, Jason Clark and Riley Keough, who's Elvis's granddaughter, play a couple. I can't even tell you what they do. They're mass murderers, and they torture people before they lure them into murder and photograph them. And of course, like everything in the movie, he justifies it by saying, I wanted to be close to God. That's how I feel close to God. And basically, Donald Ray Pollock, the author of the novel, is the narrator of the film. And it's also lousy hillbilly accents that a bunch of European actors, including a Swedish actor, try to do. This is a wretched film. And the fact that it is getting any kind of critical acclaim is just that notion that even when you do a film that does a cartoon version of American religion and treats Christian faith, which uplifts so many millions of people, so many billions of people every day, when you treat it with such contempt and horror, and the canine crucifixion here is also unspeakable. It is not a film that most people, even who tune it on in unsuspectingly, will watch to the end. It's that bad. Please be warned. Speaking of being warned, a major university, very prestigious university, has published a graphic guide to safe sex in a COVID-19 era. And yes, it involves masks. But what else? I mean, you're going to wear masks and you're going to... Okay, we'll cover that. We will also be talking about a new movie about a riot that broke out at a worldwide beauty pageant in London, the Miss World competition, in 1970, which that riot now is documented in a pretty good movie with Keira Knightley that we will review next time in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.